Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow marks the two-year anniversary of the death of Michael Brown, the unarmed black teenager who was shot and killed by Darren Wilson, a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri. Community members gather to celebrate Michael Brown's life and discuss police violence over the weekend. Today's guest, Michael Denzel Smith, was in Ferguson for the one-year anniversary. In his new book, Invisible Man, he writes, quote, "Whether or not the new movement produced any substantial policy changes felt secondary in those moments, as I heard 5- and 6-year-old marchers chant along that Black Lives Matter. What they would know, regardless of the political outcome of the movement, was that someone thought their life mattered. Thousands of people had come to their hometown to stand with them and assert their right to live free. That is a revolution in itself," end quote. Michael Denzel Smith came of age during the presidency of Barack Obama and the killing of black men and women, and he asks, how do you learn to be a black man? In his new memoir, Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education, Michael Denzel Smith interrogates the contradicting and limiting narrative of black lives. Michael Denzel Smith is a Nobler Fellow at the Nation Institute and a contributing writer for The Nation magazine. He has written for many outlets, including The New York Times and Salon, and he joins us from Clayton Studios in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. So you are in Ferguson, Missouri right now, reporting on the two-year anniversary of Michael Brown's death. Over the weekend, a number of community members gathered to rally. They went to various discussions to take part. Tell us about what's happening there right now, and how are people reflecting?
Oh, I wish I could. My travel plans were messed up yesterday, and I wasn't able to get on the ground until very late. So I'm I'm behind on my reporting.
Oh,
right,
okay.
Now.
Well, we'll talk about how you're reflecting.
It's sobering to just realize how much time has passed and how little has changed. That we're 2 years out from what was supposed to be this watershed moment in the death, the killing of Michael Brown, of his body laying in the street for 4.5 hours. And yet we still are being faced with a level of police violence and very little in the way of reform that speaks to the ways in which black life has always been policed in the United States, and that we're witnessing it now, though, that we can see Alton Sterling be killed, that we can see the aftermath of Philando Castile's death, that we can now be talking about and trying to understand the way in which Corinne Gaines in Baltimore County was killed. The ways in which progress is so very slow to happen in this country, but then recognizing that that's always the case. When Emmett Till was killed in 1955, that seemed also a watershed moment. But it's not until 1964 that we get the Civil Rights Act. You know, It takes a long time, and so these movements gestate for quite some time. But you know, we're also witnessing, you know, the collaboration of about 50 organizations coming under the banner of the Movement for Black Lives, offering a program for different policy prescriptions for ending this sort of police violence, but also establishing the rights of black communities to live with respect and human dignity and access to all of the resources needed to confer that upon them, to radically reimagine the way in which our democracy and our economy work with equality and justice at the basis of those systems, as opposed to something that's supposed to be imposed upon a system of hierarchy. In the wake of witnessing tragedy, what we're seeing now, and what I'm reflecting on, is just how movements work, how movements can produce change, and how long that takes.
Yeah. No, it's such a good point. It takes so long. And I was struck by so many things in your book. I read the quote, what you wrote about when you were in Ferguson last year. And I think this is just so important because with so much media attention on Black Lives Matter, on police killings, on, you know, the mothers who took the stage at the Democratic National Convention, the Black mothers of their children who were shot and killed, and we'll talk about that later in the show, something you wrote about just doesn't get that much attention, and that is last year when you were in Ferguson, you write that regardless of what happens, so many of the people who live in Ferguson felt like their lives mattered. You write about the 5-year-olds, the 6-year-olds who were out marching, and so many people were just happy that others from other parts of the country came out to say, yes, your life matters. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and really what I was trying to think through, and I'm not even quite sure, just because, again, time will tell what this really means, is that what will it mean for those 5- and 6-year-olds to grow up in movement times when people are showing up, getting arrested, you know, filling the streets to prove and establish that Black life matters, that their lives matter, that they don't want them to grow up in a system, to grow up in a country, in a society that devalues them, that will kill them at the drop of a dime. You know, what will it mean for, what effects does it have on the psyche of those young children, particularly knowing that the world, again, is not going to shift in such a way in which their life will suddenly be valued in exactly the way that it will, that it should be. They're still going to grow up in a system of oppression on different fronts, but someone has established for them that their life matters. So will they continue this fight? Will they cede the existence of racism and simply try to overcome? Is there something missing in my vision of fighting racism that they're going to see and that I can't even conceptualize right now? I mean, that's probably the case, but it is going to be different than the way in which I grew up, in which we were past Black Power. We were past Black is Beautiful. We were in an era of, you know, colorblindness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't see race. At the same time, talking about diversity and multiculturalism, like embracing different cultures and races, but not seeing them. You know, there's a different messaging happening now. And it's going to produce a generation that we're not entirely sure the way in which that message was received, but I can only imagine that the levels of self-esteem that these children will have in the face of these forms of oppression will only be heightened in a way that my generation simply didn't experience.
We'll talk a little bit more about that and your upbringing, because I think it's important to talk about where you're from, your parents, what they expected of you, to kind of learn more about how you got to where you are today. You write that your parents sent you to college to become a credit to your race. It was never said in those exact words, but the idea was planted early on that my life would be one where I would defy all of the stereotypes associated with being a Black man. You write that you weren't allowed to sag your pants or say the N-word or listen to rap music. Your mother corrected your English when you dropped your G's or started a sentence with me and. You weren't supposed to ever give anyone the opportunity to think of you as less than. You also write that your father wanted you to be an upstanding citizen with unimpeachable credentials who could gain everyone's respect, so they might see you as more than just another Black man and come to see you as a man. And I think this line says so much. Your parents wanted you to become Barack Obama.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly the sort of what that produces is the most respectable Black man in United States history. And then when I say respectable, what I mean is that he adheres to every single metric of success and respectability within the confines of the American systems of capitalism and white supremacy and patriarchy and heterosexism, right? He embodies all of the right things. He has the right pedigree in terms of his educational background, in terms of overcoming obstacles, right? He had a single mother and they grew up in poverty. He overcame that. He married someone who is his intellectual and professional equal. They're raising two beautiful children, right? Like, he has been a successful politician. He's been successful in his chosen career. Like, all of those things are a result of would be a result or the imagined result of teaching black children to be twice as good. That as long as you conduct yourself in this way and you pursue these things that are deemed respectable, then there are no obstacles in your way. You will be accepted by society, and you will be successful on the terms that we have defined success. And Barack Obama is the embodiment of all of that. The problem there, though, is that it is not a challenge to the system of racism. It is not a challenge to systems of oppression. What it is a recognition of their existence, but also an assignation of them to personal bigotries that one simply can sidestep or step or overcome by virtue of your own personal grit and wherewithal. And so that's the messaging that I got, that essentially what I was supposed to do was to assimilate, that I was supposed to recognize the existence of racism, but never let it bother me. But what that does then is cede the existence of racism to some type of natural order, as if it is an inevitability, as if it is not a system that we can dismantle and that we can establish equality and justice for all people in the beginning, as if that that what black people are experiencing is an oppression of their own making. And so rejecting that later on meant a critique of not only my parents in the lessons that they tried to impart on me, but as a critique of a survival technique for black people. And that gets into tricky territory, because I would never want to step on those survival techniques to say that, you know, what we've done to simply make it to ensure that we keep our lives is something to be disrespected. But it is also to note the limitations of that survival technique, and in that in our continuing survival, we have not produced challenges to the system, or within that particular survival technique, it does not produce challenge to the system that will alter the lives for all of us. It is a way in which we can ensure that some of us do survive, and that those people will experience all the fruits of the American system, but it will be denied to the rest of us.
You write that President Obama needed to basically be Michael Jordan, amazing and black, without reminding anyone he was black. He had to run to become president of the United States, not president of black America. And you write that one of your father's most memorable moments is voting for Barack Obama. And I'm sure this is the case for a lot of people in your, not only your father's generation, but so many blacks across the country. I'm sure you've talked to your dad about all of your thoughts. Your parents, have they read your book? What are their thoughts about the journey that you're on right now?
I have no idea if they've read it.
Oh, really?
My dad bought 10 copies, but I'm not sure if he's read the book. And it's whether or not we talk about that is irrelevant to me, simply because I know where we disagree. And if they change their minds about things, then that's great. But I'm not, I'm also just, I know my parents, and I know that they're stubborn, and I know that it's hard to get them to shift off of their understanding and their access, particularly my father. It's a memorable moment, not just for my father. It was memorable for me in that my reluctance of doing it, the circumstances that brought me to the poll, with my father waking me up at 4 a.m. to get there. it was memorable, but like the pull of history to one vote for Barack Obama in the first time that I was eligible to vote in a presidential election, and to help I voted in Virginia, and it was in part because Virginia turned blue that Barack Obama was able to become president, to have helped elect the first black president in the United States, to sit there with my younger brother as he gave his speech that night, that really is a history defining moment. It was memorable, but the representational politics, the symbolism, simply took a back seat after that moment. Really, not after that moment, but after Oscar Grant was killed, I think, on January 1st, 2009, witnessing that video and just it snapping us out of that, or snapping me out of that haze of romanticization of the American progress, is that, realize once again, more of us are going to be Oscar Grant than we are going to be Barack Obama. And with that realization at the heart of our understanding of the world, the question then becomes, why is that, and what are we going to do about it?
Today, I'm speaking with Michael Denzel Smith, author of Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education. He grew up in a conservative country during the George W. Bush years, the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, Hurricane Katrina, the recession, and now President Obama, social media, and Black Lives Matter. And Michael writes for The Nation. He's joining us from Ferguson, where he's about to cover the two-year anniversary of Michael Brown, the killing of Michael Brown by Darren Wilson, the white police officer there. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. It's so interesting to talk about generational differences. When we do shows about Black Lives Matter and these issues, a lot of young people on the show say they come at this from a very different perspective from their parents. And so if you'd like to talk about the generational differences that you see, we'd love to hear from you. And also, what are your thoughts on the Black Lives Matter movement and where it is today? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you are a young person, we'd love to hear about how politics and pop culture has influenced your political actions. You can also tweet @yourcallradio. Michael Denzel Smith is author of Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching. Michael, you also point out that one of the more frustrating things about President Obama is that he did all the, quote, right things, as you just listed them, right? He went to Harvard, he got married, he worked, he dreamed big, he pulled himself up by his bootstraps. He did everything right. And yet, he was called an African witch doctor. People asked him for his birth certificate. A congressman shouted at him, "You lie." He faced the most recalcitrant Republican Congress ever that was elected by a constituency that wanted to, quote, take the country back. So at the same time, he gave speeches before a graduating class of, is Morehouse all black men?
Yes.
Okay, so at Morehouse, he gave a speech in May 2013. I think this is so interesting. So he lectures these black men and basically said, nobody cares how tough your upbringing was. Nobody cares if you suffer from discrimination. You have to remember that whatever you've gone through, it pales in comparison to the hardships previous generations endured, and they overcame them. And if they overcame them, you can too. And, you know, I think what you write just says so much. You write, someone should care, though. It would be nice if the president these young men were supposed to see themselves in cared. Can you talk about that and what a mistake it is to say nobody cares how tough your upbringing was?
Well, yeah, it's been one of the most infuriating aspects of Barack Obama's visibility, his presidency, but him being a public figure in the from that particular position too, right? He has gone before black audiences and not spoken to the experience of racism, in which he's not obligated to do necessarily. But what he has done is lectured as if from the position of black deficiency being the norm and being the truth, that what he needs to tell these particularly young black men, his lectures are generally pointed in their direction, about, you know, the way that they dress, or about being good fathers, about, you know, studying hard. And one of the things that's so striking about that particular moment is he's giving a commencement address. He's talking to college graduates who presumably have done something quote unquote right. But he continues to say these things as if the existence of these forms of oppression can be diminished, as if though they haven't overdetermined the lives of these young black people, and that they can all just follow the example that he has set, as if that's totally possible for 40 million black people, you know, and it's. It's hard to continue to witness, particularly now as we continue to see the deaths at the hands of police and vigilantes for young black people, as we continue to witness the effects of the prison industrial complex in the era of mass incarceration, as we look at Flint, as we look at the water being poisoned. I mean, we're talking about people drinking poisoned water, and they're supposed to just lift themselves up by their bootstraps. The disconnect there, and the disconnect between his own experience as the first black president. I mean, he has done everything right, quote unquote, right. He did everything that he was supposed to do to achieve his dreams. And the most powerful and respectable black man in the United States history is also met with racist backlash. So what is that supposed to mean for the rest of us that cannot live up to the standard that he has set? What is supposed to mean for the black masses of us? You know, and what does it mean that Barack Obama refuses to acknowledge that, particularly from his position as the most powerful and visible black man and successful black man in United States political history? What does it mean for that first black president to lend legitimacy to racist ideas about black deficiency? It's a troubling thing to wrestle with, given the way in which he is adored within black communities. it's a tough balance to try to make, because there is some level of respect due to him on the basis of it being very difficult to be elected president of the United States and be elected president of the United States with a name like Barack Hussein Obama and being a black man. That's hard.
So true. And I would love listeners to weigh in on this, because we have had conversations about how President Obama has, quote, done the right thing every time and yet still gets massive backlash from politicians. And I mean, we've seen it over the last 8 years, but I haven't really heard anyone put it quite like this. He's doing the right thing, and that yet at the same time, he's giving commencement addresses to black men and basically saying, no one cares about what you've gone through. And Michael Denzel Smith's argument is that someone needs to care, because we're dealing with a lot of people who've got untreated mental illness. So what are your thoughts on this? Now that Barack Obama is going to leave office soon. We need to have this conversation. Now is the perfect time to have this. So what would you like to add to it? Michael Denzel Smith is author of Invisible Man Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org, leave a comment at yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio. Mosquitoes and Zika virus are the topics for investigation on Reveal, 11 o'clock this morning, 1/2 hour from now, here on 91.7 KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about whether we are experiencing a political turning point for Native Americans. There are at least 73 American Indians, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians serving in 19 state legislatures, and many more are running for office. It is very rare for people who have suffered the loss of land and culture to have political power. But now that this is slowly changing, what differences might we see? That's tomorrow. And on Wednesday, we are going to talk about sexual harassment in our professional and personal lives. That's on Wednesday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I'm speaking with Michael Denzel Smith. He is out with a new book, Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education. Michael is a Nobler Fellow at the Nation Institute and a contributing writer for The Nation magazine. He's got a great story in his book about writing his first piece for The Nation while he was in college. He wrote an editor who was following him on Twitter, and she wrote back the very next day and said, great, we'd love to take that piece. So that's such a great story, especially at a time when it's hard to get journalism jobs these days. He's written for The New York Times, The Atlantic, and The Guardian. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Michael was just 25 when Trayvon Martin was killed. And like so many black men who do not reach adulthood, he thought he wouldn't make it to 25. So what are your thoughts on where we are right now? There's so much attention on Black Lives Matter. We talked a couple weeks ago about the mothers of young black men and children who've been shot and killed. They took to the stage of the Democratic National Convention. Some mothers said they wouldn't take the stage. So what are your thoughts about where we are right now? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Before we get to calls, Michael, I just want to get your thoughts about what you wrote in your book. When President Obama said, you know, nobody cares about the tough upbringing you had, when he gave that address to college grads, you say someone needs to care. And you write that black people pride themselves on the fact that they've survived in America despite having every form of violence inflicted upon them. You write, with every odd imaginable set against us, we have persevered through the strength of our collective will and faith in Jesus. But neither our will nor faith can adequately heal the psychic wounds of that survival. And you write that so many of the men you know are dealing with violence and untreated mental illness. In fact, you were also dealing with this. So can you talk about why that's such an important part of this conversation?
Yeah. In that chapter of the book, it's wholly about mental health, mental illness, and the impact on black male life. And it was important for me that that be the most personal one, because there's a dearth of black men accounting for mental illness within their own lives and telling those stories and simply saying to other folks, you are not alone. This is happening to many of us. So accounting for my experience and diagnosis of with anxiety disorder and depression and tracing where that comes from, it was very important. And I think that, you know, for me, what it is if we ask the question or frame Black male life as we understand it with the question with mental health being more at the forefront and offering primacy to that as a concern, then it reshapes the way in which we have conversations about those lives. So, you know, one thing that happens in the wake of a lot of police shootings is that the retort is always, well, what about black on black crime, right? And we know, like, the fallacy of that itself as is a rhetorical device, as a statistical aberration. But what about the fact that within black communities, people are being killed? There is so much violence happening perpetrated by one black person onto another that people are witnessing this violence. Well, if we ask the question from the perspective of concerns for people's mental health, we would then ask about the experiences of post-traumatic stress disorder for those people who experience living with gunshots every night. People who are experiencing the death of their loved ones on a regular basis. We would ask about the ways in which so much of this retaliatory violence could be stopped if more social services were offered and that people were given spaces to heal. And the fact that we would ask about why so many of these young people are willing to risk their lives over seemingly nothing. Mm-hmm. What is it about? Why would we not classify that as suicidal? And then if we ask why they're, you know, what their lives are like, that they would feel like they have nothing, then we would get to questions around poverty and lack of access to adequate education and housing and apparently water. All of these things. I just want to keep reminding us that Flint's water is still poisoned.
Right.
But, you know, all of these different things that if we were to consider the impact of all of these various forces on the mental health of people living in these communities, we would ask different questions and we would come to different solutions around how to solve these problems. And then we wouldn't worry about the retort black on black crime. We would be attempting to solve the violence at its root as opposed to imposing some more draconian measures of police violence and oppression. But I mean, and also, I mean, the mental drain of, you know, one's everyday existence. What does it feel like? How do you feel when you are rejected from a job, from jobs over and over again, when you can't get loans to start a business that someone tells you you're supposed to be entrepreneurial? What does it mean when you're witnessing that your children and having their schools closed, they don't have access to parks and things. So what does that feel like? And then what does that impact of the deterioration of your mental health have on your interactions with other people and the way in which that often turns violent? If we consider mental illness, if we consider mental health at the core of our concern and our advocacy and our activism, it just alters the way we view the world and the way in which we fight for access to these resources.
Obviously, Chicago gets a lot of attention because of the violence happening there. And I just saw a headline this morning, 3 dead, 23 wounded in shootings Saturday through early Sunday. 3 dead in Chicago, 23 wounded. And the New York Times, I think it was about 2 months ago, they sent a number of reporters to interview people who've been shot and killed or shot and wounded in Chicago. And it was this in-depth, really long story, so many photos. And yet, Michael, the story did not touch on hardly any of the issues that you just brought up. It was basically a play-by-play of what happened, but nothing mm-hmm. about what's actually happening in these communities, the social issues.
Right. It's because we don't make those connections. We particularly when it comes to black male violence, it becomes pathologized, right? It is inherent within black men. Like, this is their nature. This is just what they do. As if We weren't saying the same things at the turn of the 19th century about, you know, German and Irish and Italian and Jewish immigrant groups who existed in similar conditions to newly emancipated Black people, conditions similar to what we experience today in terms of a lack of resources, a lack of investment in communities, and a disregard for their humanity. What happened was those that liberal progressive groups looked at those immigrants and decided that what they needed was more education. They needed adequate housing. They needed jobs. That it wasn't their fault. It wasn't something that they were born with. It wasn't that they were something born into. It was the fault of the social system. Our system of economics. They decided that they were worthy of that investment, and they fought to get the Germans and the Irish and the Italians access to those things. And those groups were then folded into whiteness. They weren't previously white. They were German before that. They were Italian, and then they became white. And by virtue of that, they have they've flourished because of their proximity to and then acceptance into whiteness. The same can't be said for the ways in which Black communities have been treated. It's always been a matter of telling Black people that the reason you are experiencing this degraded experience is by your own making. It's because you refuse to play by the rules. You refuse to be lawful. But the fact of the matter is that these things only become exacerbated by the conditions which people grow up in, and they become exacerbated by poverty. A lot of these things that we're talking about are are part of human experience, but they're socialized behaviors on the basis of the way in which you're brought up within an oppressive system. So if we were to remove that, or we were to fix that, the outcomes for Black people would be different. But we, because of a commitment to white supremacy underpinning our systems of governance and economy, we then say to Black people that it is your fault. And that's the way that we document this violence, is that it is not a result of social systems. It is a result of your own personal failures.
Michael Denzel Smith is author of Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. And let's hear from Chris in San Francisco. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi.
Go ahead.
I haven't read your book, but speaking as a Black person, I'm just wondering, do you think the Black community can do anything better?
Michael, were you able to hear Chris?
Can the Black community do anything better?
Chris, do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, I guess my point is, it's obvious that we face an uphill battle, right? I wasn't born in this country, but it's obvious that there's systemic racism. It's obvious that the average Black kid faces a battle to make it. But having said that, is there anything we can do better?
Well, you know, what this speaks to, I just wanted, we've been doing the best that we can. We've been doing the absolute best that we can throughout our existence here, with all of the odds that have been put in front of us, with all of the obstacles that we've had to face. We've done the absolute best that we can at every turn, and people are fighting every single day for their survival. What are we supposed to do better with the circumstances as they are? And I just think, you know, one, things do shift. Certain forms of oppression wither away or are dismantled by virtue of revolutionary thought and action, and the determination of the oppressed to convince the oppressor to give it up. and certain things change, and certain but other things just continue to morph. Other things continue to persist, and so I don't know what we're supposed to do in the face of that, other than continue to fight it. What are we supposed? I don't know what thing are we supposed to do better.
Chris, are you still there?
I don't know. I just think your message is very defeatist, and I think it does a disservice to young black babies that have been born into this country. At this point, they have no choice but to face the lives that they're given, and I think it's the wrong mentality to tell them they can do nothing about it, that their families can do nothing about it, but just do the best that they can do, which is what you say we've been doing all this time. I think it's the wrong attitude. I think it's unfair to black kids in particular that I've been.
My attitude isn't defeatist, though. I think it's a matter of which thing are you looking at, right? My attitude would be perceived as defeatist if what you're asking is for me to say to young black kids, well, if you go to school and you get good grades, and if you go to the right schools, and then you get the right jobs, and you fight that way, then obviously your life will be okay. And for some people, that may be true. One, not everyone is going to have access to that. That's not the way that our economy is built. Like, not everyone's supposed to or is going to be able to have access to those lives. Like, there has to be an exploitable class for the way in which our economy is set up. So there's that. But my attitude is not defeatist, in that I do believe that the system of racism can be dismantled. I do believe that systems of oppression can be dismantled, and that we can then completely, radically reimagine what democracy and economies look like on the basis of equality and justice. What I'm not going to say is that it is the job of the oppressed to overcome those systems. I do not think that what that has produced is a number of tokens within the system, and has not produced a fairer or more just world for the masses of people that are going to continue to experience it. What I would like to defeat is the system itself, not to simply accept the system's existence and to impart upon black youth the idea that it is their job to bend to the will and the mores of that system.
Chris, thank you for calling in.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you. Couple of things. I just heard the comment that he made, and I think it's absolutely correct. This system has to be changed at every level, and I'm not sure it's going to be accomplished through the electoral process. I do think that mass movement is what's needed, but, I've been involved and tried to engage in mass movements since the late 60s, and look where we are. I wanted to get back to a couple of things, though, that you've been talking about. One was Obama. Clearly, Obama has faced deep-seated racism in dealing with both Congress and the country. And so that's certainly an obstacle, even though I think Obama is part of the establishment. You don't get elected to be president of the United States, whether you're black or white or Hispanic or whatever, unless you are part of the establishment. I was disappointed when I voted for Obama, but I realized over time that he is part of the establishment. That speech to the people, I think it was you said at Morehouse,
right,
that he made, that's a strange speech for him to give, because in a way it's almost like he's been treated poorly, I guess, as he's risen up, but I wouldn't call him part of the poor, black masses in this country. He is in an elite position, and that speech reeks of elitism, that speech to the students at Morehouse. So that's a sort of strange position for him to be in. I want to ask one other thing about your guest and see if he'd comment on this about the police. If the date that you gave for the Oscar Grant murder was 2009, which I think I heard somebody say that, it's hard to believe that it's been 7 years since Oscar Grant was killed. And that may be true, but the fact of the matter is, it's still happening. You'd think that after all this stuff is going on, that there would be something done about this, that it would be, there would really be some serious efforts to change this. I think the problem is really much more deep-seated than just getting accountability for the police, which I think they need, and that's this. I think the police are doing their job. That's what they are. They're a part of the state. They are an arm of the state, and their job is to maintain control and order. And that's why this stuff continues to happen. Look what happened in Baltimore. All those guys were acquitted in that Freddie Gray trial,
right,
by that judge. And you'd think, my God, I mean, what are they talking about? And so that's what I think is going on here. It's part and part. They are part and part of the establishment and the order. And that's why you're not going to get a change until you can change that.
Thank you, Greg. Michael, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes. I mean, that's the thing is so much of the discussion gets wrapped around the individual actions of police officers without examining the job that they've been sent out to do, right? Like this is a matter of policy. This is not. What the confusion that comes in when we witness these things on video is that the police officers are like, what do you mean? We're doing exactly what we've been asked to do. And that is the maintenance of systems of oppression. And that's why I'm not concerned about, for the families who have been victimized by police violence, I completely understand the desire to see the system hold them accountable, but that will not alter the police's job. And the problem is that what we do as a society is that we foment social decay, and then we send in the police officers to fix everything as if they have more weapons than just their guns and arrest, as if that's going to solve the problem, right? Like, that's not going to solve the problem of poverty. What it's going to do is make the poor disappear into jails. It's not going to solve the problem of homelessness. It's going to make the homeless disappear into prisons. It doesn't do what we think it's going to do. It doesn't alter crime itself. It just locks people up. It doesn't alter the realities that produce the crime and produce the homelessness and produce the poverty and produce mental illness, mm-hmm. That we also send the police officers out to try to fix. It's a matter of do we want to change the police officer's job? And the problem there is that we don't want to change the police officer's job because we don't want to change the way that our society is structured. We are committed to hierarchies. We are committed to a certain idea around who is and who is not worthy of the spoils of American capitalism. It's tough to alter that mindset, but it is true that what we need is movement. Movements take time because shifting the consciousness of enough people to produce the type of change that we're asking for is difficult, particularly with the entrenched power systems that we have and people committed to the protection of their own status, protection of their own identity. That is tough. So what I tried to lay out in my book is the process of what that self-interrogation looks like and why one would want to divest from systems of oppression that have conferred upon them benefits and power and privilege, but how to start asking those questions. And hopefully what it means is those of us who are committed to these ideas of liberation, equality, and justice start to do that work.
We only have about a minute left, but one of the big takeaways from your book is, as you say, fighting bigotry in all of its forms. You write that unless we recognize that the liberation for black men based in patriarchy and male dominance is liberation for no one, least of all black women, but not for black men either, it turns us into the very oppressors we claim to be fighting against. I also like what you write about in terms of reframing the way we understand black male life. You write, if we looked outside and didn't see ruthless gangbangers but teenage boys left hopeless and giving them themselves suicide missions? If instead of chastising young men for fighting over sneakers, we asked why they feel worthless and unseen without them? If we believed black boys were worthy of second chances that did not involve prison cells, what if? We might start to worry, and then we might start to heal. Michael, we have so many conversations about these issues, and I think you added so much to the conversation. What are your final thoughts? What are you planning to do next?
I want to continue to push us to consider those questions and know that there are going to be more questions that I didn't think of, that in order to establish this new vision and then implement that vision for what a society looks like that respects each individual's personal experience and identity, that establishes identities that are not based in the oppression and denigration of others, that we have to do some deep soul searching and interrogation of ourselves, that it really does start with us in that respect, and that we have to be willing to let go. We have to be willing to let go of the things we think we like about ourselves, because if they are things that deny others access to respect and dignity and humanity, then they're not things worth having. So we have to be willing to let go. And my project is to continue asking those questions, continue pushing people to ask those questions of themselves, and hopefully be ready when I'm challenged to do the same.
Michael Denzel Smith writes for The Nation magazine. He's a Nobler Fellow at The Nation Institute. And his book is Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching, A Young Black Man's Education. Michael, thank you for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.